Anthony Lowenstein, the author of Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World, joins us. Good morning, Anthony.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Very well, thank you. We should point out to our listeners that you're a bit of a troublemaker, aren't you, Anthony?
Try to be.
I know. I just thought before we begin, we'd get that sorted out. You come from a Jewish background, and you've been attacked by people who say that you've taken the wrong position on Palestine, haven't you?
You could say that. Yes. Yeah. I'm an anti Zionist atheist Jew who's very critical of the way Israel treats the Palestinians very, very badly. Yes.
Yeah, well,
amongst other things.
Amongst other things, yep. So you haven't got a lot of friends from the Israeli Chamber of Commerce and groups like that, I imagine.
Yeah. Thankfully not, no.
Now, but your book, is it going to cause a few more people to sit up and put you on their list of people they won't send Christmas cards to this time?
Well, we certainly hope so. One of the ideas behind the book is to look at how, make the argument that the corporation has become more powerful than the state. Now, I'm not the first person to say that, of course. But one of the things that's happened in the last 30 years, roughly, is in many areas, war, aid, resources, asylum seekers, what the state has done in Australia, the US, the UK, other places, is outsourced many of its services to the private sector. And the result of that has been that accountability has disappeared. War, for example, Iraq and Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan last year. Many people don't realize this, but there are, for example, right now, in Afghanistan, more private contractors than there are soldiers. There's about 110,000 Western contractors. Now, they're not all fighters, but there are a number of private militias that the West supports and arms and trains. Not much accountability, not much discussion, not much transparency. And I guess what the book tries to do by looking at examples in Papua New Guinea, Australia, Haiti, and other places, is to say that we've really created a situation, and it's bipartisan, it pretty much gets supported by many in the media, of a situation where on a lot of questions we actually don't really have accountability within our system to examine which companies are making money, how they're making money, and why they're making money. And I think this kind of thing, as is often the case as a journalist, I say to myself, follow the money, and this is what I've tried to do.
Well, yeah, I must say you're very brave to fly into Kabul and have a good look around. A lot of people who write about these things don't actually do it. I have some people that have been there, and of course know people from the ABC and elsewhere who have been in there, and they said that it's a pretty extraordinary place. In fact, on Four Corners last night, they showed some scenes of Kabul. They went back with a man who'd had both his legs blown off and his arm blown off in a bomb blast, and he went back to one of those centres where they provide people with prosthetic limbs. And what I was amazed by was the number of four-wheel drives, flash brand new cars, the traffic jams as he was travelling around Kabul. And it does seem to be a sort of place that seems to be awash with, a certain number of people that are awash with wealth, aren't they?
There is. I think one of the myths that has been perpetuated by pretty much our leaders and many in the media who support these wars, even those who oppose it, who don't talk about this, is that since 9/11, obviously the Afghan war started, and then Iraq in 2003, is that a lot of the services that the government would traditionally have done were outsourced to a range of companies, military contractors, many of whom were former soldiers themselves. But the kind of human rights abuses that were perpetuated were massive. One very short example, in my book I investigate the role of intelligence. You know, we always hear about the role of intelligence, but intelligence has increasingly been outsourced to companies, and clearly private companies are out to make a profit. That's not exactly a revelation, but the problem is the information they're often giving to governments is exaggerated or wrong because they want to perpetuate a situation or get more contracts. So the US has been in Afghanistan, as have we, for over a decade. And one of the things that strikes you, and we're obviously going to be leaving there, apparently, mostly by the end of this year, is the profound ignorance that still exists by the Australians, by the Americans, by the others, Western forces, about what actually is going on in that country. Why is there an insurgency? Why are there people who are against us? And one of the crazy things about this is that many of the reasons that actually have been hated is because we in the West, Australia, the US, and many other countries have been paying contractors to provide intelligence, which is then used on these so-called night raids. Listeners may have heard of night raids, which is used as a reason to supposedly get terrorists and the Taliban, but actually regularly sweeps up countless innocent people, Many are killed. And of course that breeds an insurgency. So, but the private aspect of that is little discussed, and I think it needs to be far more than it does.
I'm talking to Anthony Lowenstein about his latest book, Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. I'm particularly interested, though, in your trip to Kabul and your trip to Afghanistan, because this is something that I think we hear a bit of, but we don't hear enough about this. And this is the issue of the money that is in there related to drugs and heroin. I mean, you point out in your book that there are around 1 million users of opium in the country itself out of a population of 35 million.
Yes.
Now that seems an that'd be like having about, getting close to 1 million people in Australia, wouldn't it? I mean, if you've got 25 Indeed. Million in Australia, you've got the population's not much bigger, but they've got 1 million users of opium. I mean, that must make it and 40% of the addicts are women and children. Now this,
Indeed.
I had no idea of this. And you've got these from, these figures from who? The United
UN.
Nations?
I mean, to actually get exact figures are impossible because you can imagine the country is it's a difficult place to get accurate figures, but these are coming from the UN drug figures, so they're as accurate as they can be. One of the things that people often forget is that obviously opium and drugs were a problem before 9/11. No one's suggesting that was brought in all by the US when we invaded in 2001, but the effect was the Taliban, as brutal as it was, basically tried to stop opium production. Fast forward to 2001, the war started. We've been there, of course, for more than 10 years. And the effect has been that the US and really Australia and many other countries have turned not just a blind eye to the drug trade, because the reality is for so many local farmers, they have no choice but to grow poppies because they have no alternative. The reason addiction is so high, including women and children, is that because this country has been racked with war for now 30 years, but including, of course, in the last decade, is that many people go to Iran, they try to get work, often can't get work, they get thrown to jail. Opium addiction there is massive, as it is in jails there and Iran. I was in Iran a few years before. And you see in many areas of Afghanistan, despite the argument that we hear by our leaders that we're fighting a war on drugs, the truth is that we're actually turning a blind eye to a war on drugs.
Well,
that's the reality, you know.
Well, on that point, if you've actually got an economy where you've got 1 million users using opium in the country itself, and then there must be a lot of opium coming out of that country that's going onto the world market as well, because
massive.
So what is going to happen? What's your prediction of what will happen as slowly the West withdraws? Will we see a massive movement of drug production in the country, or is it going to just stay at the same level, or will the Taliban come in and burn the crops, or what's going to happen?
Interesting question. Yeah, as I said, when they're in power in the late 90s and early part of the last decade, the Taliban basically stopped, or tried to stop anyway, production of these kind of drugs. They these days, though, since very much they've been fighting a war with the US for over a decade, have been getting funds themselves from the drug trade. What will happen after the West mostly pulls out? Look, it's impossible to say, but at the moment, for example, a lot of the heroin around the world and opium, the vast, vast majority, comes from Afghanistan. It's hard to see that changing, really.
Well, that's an extraordinary revelation, isn't it? I mean, you've stated it quite clearly in the book. In other words, we've gone into a country to assist it, and we've ended up producing one of the biggest heroin-producing countries in the world.
Well, I suppose I would even question the premise of that point, which is, did we go in there to help the country at all? And I think one of the things that you see in so much detail is that actually from the beginning, I'm not suggesting there were no people who had goodwill who went in there, certainly from the NGO human rights world. Human rights abuses before 9/11 were appalling. They remain appalling. There's no question about that. But the way that we have empowered and funded and supported the most brutal warlords, often private militias that we are funding ourselves, as in ourselves being Australia, paying off various militias to allow free passes through dangerous areas, that's the legacy. And all the kind of bollocks, frankly, that we're going to be hearing in the next 6-12 months that we've left some kind of positive legacy there, the truth is that the people that we've empowered, putting aside the drugs for a second, the individuals and the warlords in Uruzgan province where Australia has been for many years, when we leave, and I have many colleagues of mine who spend time in that area, will say outside the Australian media bubble where too many journalists spend their time, the legacy is going to be bad. We've contributed very, very little, and worse, we've actually worsened the situation, because when you enrich local and international private industry, which is what my book looks at in detail, you're actually creating a situation where a vacuum appears when you potentially leave, which is what's going to happen in the next 6 or 12 months.
We're talking to Anthony Lowenstein about his book, Prophets of Doom. We'll get onto some of the other areas you cover in the book at the moment, but we're just looking at the moment for Afghanistan. And David's called in from Corn. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you, mate, for writing this book, and I'll go get it. But I'm just wondering what correlation is there, because in the 60s, 70s and 80s, with the Shan state in Burma, from Burma, Thailand and Laos, was the golden triangle for opium, and it was the biggest producer in the world. And the CIA got in there and helped the junta of the time to take over to get rid of the Shan state, which were only fighting for silver. Now, there was a lot of minerals, so I'm just wondering what correlation was there between that and Afghanistan, with America going in, because the Russia went in for mainly the mineral rights. America went in there for mineral rights, but they're leaving their legacy with opium, like they did through Burma and Thailand.
All right, well, it's Anthony Lowenstein.
Well, yeah, thank you for that question. What's fascinating is I'm actually working on a film also called Prophets of Doom, and one of the issues of that is the mineral resources in Afghanistan. The short answer is there are massive untapped resources. No one knows the exact amount, at least $1 trillion, copper, gold, etc. Because the country's been at war for so long, it's been virtually impossible to mine it. But what's been happening in the last year is China, yet again being frankly much cleverer in terms of its use of soft power than the US, has bought up many of the mines in Afghanistan. Now, they're not really doing any mining yet, but they're likely to do so if and when the security situation improves. And there are some American companies and Australian companies trying to get the mineral rights there as well. So the legacy in Afghanistan is, and I was spending time with some people there when I was visiting in 2012, some of the mining industry, and they're often being brought to Australia by the Australian government to sort of get education, so to speak, how to manage mineral rights. And I said to them, well, look, yes, Australia is not PNG, Australia is not Congo, that's obviously true, but the problem is that often Australia's foreign aid is directed to assisting mining industries in countries like, say, Papua New Guinea or Afghanistan, where the record of mismanagement and corruption is so profound, and often Australian aid, AusAid money, and I critique this in the book and say this is a profoundly problematic, where the legacy in, say, Papua New Guinea or Afghanistan towards mineral resources is so bad that we have to question why Australian governments, successive governments, are funding these kind of industries where the local people in, say, Afghanistan or PNG are not benefiting. Australian businesses are benefiting, that's for sure.
Well, is it possible, Anthony Lowenstein, that because there is a shift in world power at the moment, and the Chinese, as you say, are moving in there, that they may actually be better partners for the Afghanis in terms of their mineral wealth? Is it likely that they...
It's possible. Look, it's possible. My comment was not to be disparaging towards the Chinese at all. It was more to say that the record of China in many parts of Africa, where they've been moving very cleverly for the last 10 years, is not a wonderful record in terms of human rights either. I guess my point was that the Chinese, who have not put one soldier in Afghanistan, have not lost one man or woman to this war, have actually bought up the rights to most of the minerals in that country. And I think anyone who would look at that with Afghanistan would be rightly concerned about the likely reality of what that industry might mean. Locals are unlikely to get benefits from any kind of mineral industry, resource industry. And it concerns me, as I say in the book, many other people, that the Australian government is advising elements within the Afghan government, many of whom are profoundly corrupt, as we've known, on how to manage a resource industry when there's basically not much evidence in Afghanistan that, A, the security situation will improve, but more importantly, what actually is the Australian government through AusAid telling Afghan ministers about how to manage mineral wealth? If we're using, for example, Papua New Guinea, as often Australia does, as a model for how resources should be spent, then I think Australia should be asking itself pretty clearly what education it's giving to the Afghan people, because their resources, if they're going to be used, and the Afghans obviously have to make that decision, that's no one's choice but their own, but we have to be worried whether actual locals will get benefits. And that has to be, to me, the benchmark about whether you actually use resources or not.
Well, this brings us on to the next point, because another chapter in your book is about Papua New Guinea and the resources boom, if you like, there, and
yes.
whether the people of Papua New Guinea have benefited from that. I mean, we're now 38 years after independence, and there was and there is a lot of mineral wealth there. Have the Papua New Guinean people been assisted by the Australian government during those 38 years to ensure that there is an equitable distribution amongst the population?
Well, the soundbite answer is a little maybe yes, but the slightly longer answer is that in many, many areas of PNG, with countless companies, Rio Tinto amongst others, the environmental, it's not just destruction, it's actually well beyond that. I spent time in Bougainville, which is a province in PNG, which is looking for independence. There was a brutal war there in the 80s and 90s by locals against Rio Tinto, against the PNG government and the Australian government. The locals won. The reason there was a resistance was that the mine was incredibly polluting and also there were human rights abuses. And the problem now is, and Bougainville in some ways is the best case study of that, and I spent time there last year, is that Rio Tinto, who through its proxies in that conflict, killed countless people. The evidence for this is overwhelming. This former Rio staff say this themselves. This is not my word. This is former Rio staff themselves acknowledge that, is that there's now moves to reopen the mine. And this is the classic resource curse question, isn't it, where you have a number of locals who, not surprisingly, say, we want independence, we want economic freedom, we don't see any alternative but to reopen the mine. The problem is that many of those leaders in Bougainville are actually being paid off by the Australian government, AusAid. Again, not my word, the information is there on the record, so it's not a secret. If you ask me if any locals benefited in PNG from mining, the short answer is yes, some have, no doubt. But in many of the areas, Bougainville or Lae, where there's a upcoming ExxonMobil LNG plant worth about $20 billion, there are countless examples of local landowners and local communities who are saying, we are promised schools and hospitals and other essentials of life. They simply never come. The promises never actually get realised. And there are many people I met there who I talk about in the book who are saying, we need to, as Papua New Guineans, not simply accept the line that is sold by Australia or mining companies and say, what are the alternatives, tourism or agriculture? And it's very difficult for any country to say no to any kind of mining when there are so many resources. Very few countries will do that, and I saw that in Haiti as well. But the problem is that you have so much anger and frustration within PNG, and not just directed at Australia. But you have to ask ourselves, most people might not realise this, we give over $500 million of aid every year to PNG. It's a lot of money. And I'm not saying it all goes to waste. Some of it goes to important programs, children's health, schools, that's for sure. But a hell of a lot of it goes to corruption and goes into supporting mining companies in areas where locals are not benefiting. And I think we need to examine why that is the case.
Well, look, if people want to learn more, they can read your book, and it sounds like it'll be a film at some stage in the near future as well. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Anthony Lowenstein there. First-hand experiences in Papua New Guinea, Afghanistan, Haiti, and other places. The book's called Prophets of Doom.